Good evening. Jeff McMullen, our speaker this evening. Ian O'Connor, Vice-Chancellor of Griffith University. Ray Weeks, Chair of the Brisbane Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our first event in the Long Room for 2006. It's terrific to see such a good roll-up here tonight, and it's very pleasing to see that none of you are unduly afeard of what we're told will be an unusual occurrence from now on, any hint of rain in southeast Queensland. I'll tell you at the end what Phase 4 water restrictions will mean. Born just a few years before the introduction of television to Australia, so you've got to guess his birth date, Jeff McMullen grew up with the medium that he later mastered. Some of you, a handful of you, perhaps, hopefully more, are chronologically gifted enough to remember his work on the ABC, including me, not least his trilogy of Four Corners films from the war zones of Central America, for which he received the United Nations Media Peace Prize. Jeff's work as a journalist has taken him from the Watergate scandal to the genocide in Rwanda. And I guess he will be best known to most of you as a longer-serving 60 Minutes reporter. His extraordinary career has recently been the subject of his book, A Life of Extremes, and we'll have some copies to sell here tonight. And we're also, in effect, I guess, launching the Getting Smart edition of the Griffith Review, which will also be on sale by Riverbend Books over there later on. And if any of you have got offspring wondering about tertiary education, it's well worth the $17 to see where, you know, tertiary education's going. A good investment. Jeff McMullen is appearing at the Brisbane Institute tonight in his role as a concerned citizen, which has led him to take a close interest in environmental issues, Down syndrome children, depression and mental illness. He has been a champion of better educational support and better medical care for children in remote Aboriginal communities, and he is speaking tonight on the crisis in Aboriginal health and education. Jeff McMullen.
Good evening. Thank you for those warm words. I would echo what Peter said about this edition of the Griffith Review Journal. I think it's one of the finest in terms of looking at what all of our children are learning and challenging Australia not to be too complacent about our high literacy standard or the fact that we might have one of the best educational systems, broadly speaking, on earth, because there are some worrying signs, and this edition focuses on some of the proposals from the brightest educators in the land and from people out on the front lines doing the teaching on the difficulties. I am going to talk mainly about Aboriginal learning, and that comes from a lifelong passion and a fair bit of experience. The 50 years it is now of world wandering and writing included a great deal of filmmaking for Four Corners in the Amazon, in Central America, and among those First Nations in North America. And all of that only deepened my appreciation and respect for the world's oldest continuous culture, the one right here in this country. I'm not romanticising the distant past or even what Aboriginal life was like when whites arrived in this country a couple of hundred years ago. But unless we really begin with that kind of definite acknowledgement that there is beauty, that there is something important beyond mere resilience and beyond survival, then I don't think you can truly appreciate the scale of the threat to this culture today. There is, in the heartland of this country, a genuine emergency in both health and in education. The gap between blacks and whites in learning and life expectancy is connected. I cannot see any greater challenge than to close those gaps. I deeply believe that this is the greatest civil rights challenge facing our generation, and if we turn away, we will be like others who can always look back and second-guess those poor decisions of our forefathers, but this is the challenge on our watch. I call these children the children of the first sunrise in a recognition that this is the oldest continuous culture on earth. And yet, these children, when it comes to education and health, are usually thought of last. Every single literacy assessment from around the country, state by state or nationally, points out that by grade three, Indigenous children are around about 18 months behind the national benchmarks in literacy. By grade five, it's more worrying. By grade seven, they're up to 5 years behind those national literacy benchmarks. Now, how can any person really get through life as it is today with the literacy level of a six-year-old? How can you find your way out of the maze of poverty that Aboriginal people live in if you can't get a driver's licence, if you can't get a good job, if you can't even read the label on a medicine bottle when that medication may be necessary to prolong your life because you have multiple chronic illnesses? You soon become dependent on others. And that is the crippling effect when there is no learning for Aboriginal children. The dependence leads to that collapse that is tied in with the welfare dependency, and that kind of poverty and lack of education can be a lifelong trap. It was put to me very clearly when one of the people who drew me into this work was the Executive Director of the Jawun Association. The Jawun live in the southern part of Arnhem Land, east of Katherine. And this man said to me that even his own children were reading and writing less well than he did, and it worried him. And he said he often had to beg someone from outside to help write the letters to government desperately pleading for assistance. This powerlessness, he felt, was crippling his people. Late last year, the Jawun buried Mr. Lee. And on the day of that funeral, I could see all of the children from the surrounding communities came to Barunga. And there they were, in many cases without shoes on their feet, but most of them already had the uniform for the funeral. Aboriginal people wear white and black. And these children had that uniform before they had shoes, because month after month in those communities, there will be a funeral of a significant elder, of someone from extended family. These children are living with that trauma and stress and grieving when my kids, at the age of 10 and 12, have not yet been to a single funeral. My children have seen what happens in remote Aboriginal communities and are puzzled that some parents, that some people our age, are not with us long enough to see their children grow up and become adults. It troubled my children greatly. It made them think about what each one of us should contribute. But as I walked over to the coffin to say goodbye in the traditional way, when Aboriginal people take their sweat and press hands onto that coffin, my whispered words to Mr. Lee were that I would do what I could in my family to at least contribute to honour his vision and deeply held belief that education for all of his children is as important as it is for my own children. If the gap is there at that young age, even by grade three. We have to look closely to see where did this come from and what is the connection, as I'm arguing, to the health emergency in those same terrible zones of distress. Because Aboriginal people at the moment, those children at Barunga, are looking ahead to a life expectancy, as most of you know, 20 years less than for the rest of Australians. Those boys at Barunga are actually staring at a median age of death of 46. The girls, around about 50. And even when you widen it out to include Aboriginal people living around Brisbane that may have better access to some healthcare, you still find median age of death for Aboriginal men, round about 56. For women, round about 60. 20 years less than for the rest of the fellow Australians. But make it personal. Look around the room and imagine 45% of the men here dying before the age of 45. Or 34% of the women not reaching that same comfortable middle age. That actually is what those children at Barunga are looking ahead to. They are looking at a life sentence 20 years less than the rest of us because we have turned away from this issue. And in that same zone of distress, it's not only the gap in life expectancy, eerily, I'm confronted by the fact that there is also this gap in learning. Even before those children arrive in kindergarten to meet their first white teacher, they are well behind the average Australian kid starting school. There are very few preschools, and you might think in the beginning that that's the simple explanation. These children have not been prepared for school. It's an important point. But an American scholar, Paul Barton, in a wonderful analysis called Parsing the Achievement Gap, points to 14 factors to explain what he describes as the racial gap in learning. And what I found of greatest use to this work here in Australia is 8 of those factors occurred before the child ever got to kindergarten. And of telling importance, 3 of the most important factors were hunger, nutrition, and dangerously low birth weight babies. Why do I think low birth weight babies has much to do with education of Aboriginal children? Stay with me. 30 years ago, when I was making those Four Corners films, I had doctors in America tell me that why Native Americans weren't learning and why they were dying sooner than the rest of Americans was also because of a weak gene, is how one American doctor put it to me. And I have heard this racial excuse for us not doing more for 30 years here in Australia. It was said that Aboriginal people, like Native Americans, and curiously like African Americans, somehow all had this weak gene. It is, frankly, not only a racial excuse, it's a racist excuse that has no basis in science. Monash University, the Menzies School of Health Research in the Northern Territory, and the University of Mississippi, looking at a state in America that has the greatest amount of these kind of illnesses, the same ones that are killing Aboriginal people prematurely, began to look at the cluster of illnesses affecting people. And they went to autopsies of whites, blacks, Native Americans, Hispanic people, white Australians, Indigenous Australians. And what did they find? There was, in fact, a fascinating constant. It had nothing to do with race or weak genes. It was poverty. It hung around poverty. And when they looked closer, there was an even sharper constant. It was the dangerously low birth weight baby. From that birth came a pattern. The child in utero of a malnourished mother whose infections are not treated and who has no education, in fact, is born with a kidney programmed for the very illnesses cutting down our fellow Australians prematurely. The kidney does not compensate if you have too few nephrons. In fact, it leads to the scarring and the premature arrival of renal disease. And this is linked to the plague that the doctors in Australia now call Syndrome X. You don't see this on the front page of our newspapers, but Syndrome X is the new Black Death in this country. It is the cluster of illnesses that is leading to that 20-year gap in life expectancy. And the Monash, Menzies, University of Mississippi science shows that it goes back to a condition of poverty and a lack of education. Because an Aboriginal doctor pointed out a study to me that if we increase the education of that teenage Aboriginal mother by a single year, we can increase the life expectancy of her first baby by up to 4 years. In New South Wales, Ken Wyatt, who was the head of Aboriginal health in that state, said to me, "I'll go better than that." He said, "A single year of education for that teenage mother will reduce the chance of her losing her first baby by 7 to 10%. Here is the scientific connection also that provides the solution. We must increase the education of that teenager if you want to change the cycle that is leading to this dangerous gap in life expectancy. The gap in learning is linked to the gap in life expectancy. This is confirmed by Professor Ted Wilkes, an Aboriginal professor in Western Australia that worked with Dr. Fiona Stanley, famous as Australian of the Year. They focused on the glaring lack of education that is leading to young Aboriginal mothers, that same teenage mother, smoking through pregnancy. Roughly 49% of those surveyed by Dr. Stanley smoked through pregnancy, and 23% drank alcohol while pregnant. But the Aboriginal scholar, Professor Wilkes, said what worried him the most was they had never heard of the Quit campaign. We have not yet designed the right messages in an educational sense to reach that teenage mother. And so Professor Wilkes said, it comes back to the mother and child. The message that Dr. Stanley had in her year as Australian of the Year was, if we want to close this gap, we have to come back and close the gap in learning so that that mother realises smoking or drinking and her nutrition and her untreated infections, all of that bound up in primary health care, is not only about her health, it is indeed about the life expectancy, the quality of life, and the ability of that child in her belly one day to learn. In the Jawan communities, I watch children come into school and think, how can they ever get over this massive hurdle? They arrive not only unprepared for white fella schooling, but they arrive with middle ear infections, so that about 80% of them would not even hear a teacher standing at the front of the classroom. They have the world's highest rate of acute rheumatic heart fever. They have life-threatening illnesses as children, and usually before their first year of school, have probably been hospitalised 3 times. And in those communities, you only get hospitalised when you're ready to be evacuated. It has to be an emergency illness to warrant that kind of degree of care. For the rest of their childhood, the screening, the prevention, the education is not in place. It's why I say that literacy is about life. For Indigenous people, it is truly about life. And we have to take the science that has been prepared by Dr. Stanley, by the Menzies team, the Monash team, and look carefully at this connection, and then I think you can begin to see a way to contribute. It is true, you will soon hear complaints from some Aboriginal people and from some white people that say that that system of learning is not about Aboriginal people. You're going to impose your white fella learning, just as they have for years. And Noel Pearson has given the best answer to that. He said, unless Aboriginal parents demand of the education system that their children learn, unless there is a demand, there will not be the supply, Noel Pearson said. To put it bluntly, Many kids say to me in the remote communities, that's a gubba thing. And I understand why they say that. The gubbas were those white ghosts that floated into the lives of Aboriginal people 2 centuries ago. It's a gubba thing because this is the institution, the school, that took away their grandparents. It has not been the institution that closed the gaps. They can see that. Their people are still dependent on welfare. It hasn't opened up jobs. Their people are still unemployed. It hasn't brought wealth or home ownership or any of the other easy indicators of the quality of life of these people. The children see that they're still living in poverty. Why would you buy the promise that if you go to school and learn, that this white fella learning is going to change your life? The response to that, of course, has come from Noel Pearson, from Chris Sara at Cherbourg and Grace Sara, from one of the finest Indigenous educators in this country, the Tully elder, Ernie Grant, who designed the Indigenous teaching framework for Queensland education. These people have stood up in front of their communities and in front of the nation and said, learning is not a white thing. Every human being needs to learn. And the more impoverished you are, in some ways, the more desperate the need. Can any of you seriously tell me any other way to navigate out of that trap of poverty and welfare dependency? That's what Chris Sara was saying when he said, strong and smart, echoed here in the title of the Griffith Review Journal, strong and smart, that it is possible to be black and still believe that it is through the book, through learning, through discovery, through lifelong learning, that each of us is empowered to make those crucial changes and to find our way to better health. As the honorary CEO of Ian Thorpe's Trust, I have been mightily impressed and influenced by those Indigenous educators that have, against the odds and against, in some cases, a backlash from many quarters, have said there is no other first step. It's confirmed for me when the US Surgeon General, David Satcher, came out here after holding that job, and the reporters cornered him in Alice Springs and kept pressing until he would say something that was not diplomatic. How do we get out of this mess with people dying 20 years before the rest? And Satcher said, education, education, education. While it is true that Native Americans still do not have equality of education with white Americans, the gap has closed after a vigorous effort. When I did those Four Corners films, life expectancy for Native Americans was between 12 and 16 years behind white American life expectancy. Today, it's 3.5 to 5 years behind. Not equality, but Satcher's point was that life-empowering education, in the richest and broader sense, gives people control over their lives. And lack of education leads to that powerlessness, first in the individual, then in a family, and then in a community. And if we're not careful, eventually in the building of an underclass. When Professor Daniel Patrick Moynihan, one of the finest and brightest people I met in my travels, warned America that the disintegration of the family and the lack of education in African American society was going to be a major challenge unless we turned to education, everybody said, ooh, way too hot and sensitive. Don't want to go there. And I think we have begun to do the same. We have lost the will and perhaps the belief. It is simple at its core. We have to see that Aboriginal children, the children of the first sunrise, are our children. These are our fellow citizens. And these children can learn, and these children can be strong if we make that effort. I am not blaming teachers and principals. In most of the communities I've been to, I see them struggling. But Noel Pearson is right. We let teachers off the hook if we as a nation do not expect these children to learn or to be strong. We let the system off the hook. We let our nation off the hook. Because we make another. We have this silent apartheid a space between us. And that's the space we have to close. We can do it in many ways. The Thorpe Trust is essentially putting the tools for building a better life for those children in the hands of the communities. We go into the women's centre where the women traditionally gather with their infants and put the early learning materials, the kind of thing you'd see in a Montessori preschool, into the hand of the mother. Until we build preschools and find teachers who are willing to do that work, the mother is going to be the teacher. In the school, the teachers work with Aboriginal parents and some of the students, and they pack a literacy backpack with the right kind of reading, not just for the kids, but it goes home. It might be the Courier Mail, the Indig Times, women's magazines with nutrition and baby care, and the children then who've been living in a bookless home in a community with no public library, for the first time often see their parents read. It's shocking to think of a bookless community. When my kids first saw it, and they were much younger, this was 3 or 4 years ago, Claire and Will immediately asked an Aboriginal teacher what they could do. And they found the right books, because they listened. And Lorraine Bennett, the teacher, took those books and used them to get started the first preschool in Woogala, a small Jawan community. It was a concrete floor and a tin shed. I shouldn't use the words preschool, but that's where preschooling started. And when Susie Wilson, who runs Riverbend Books at Bulimba, heard me tell that story to the publishing industry, when I was really asking them, not telling them what to do, but challenging them. If two children can take the step and get past the words and actually do something, what are you going to do as professionals, was my challenge. And this wonderful woman at Bulimba said, I know what I'll do, we'll build the Riverbend Readers Challenge, which this month, thanks to some great novelists like David Malouf, and thanks to the Governor of Queensland, Governor Bryce, has been launched as the Australian Readers Challenge. It's a simple idea to build a bridge between communities like ours here in Brisbane that have fine public libraries and homes with books and where most people can read, to build a bridge into those places that don't have libraries, where children struggle to find anything useful to read, and where in fact illiteracy is as high as 93%. The Riverbend Challenge has become the Australian Readers Challenge because you Queenslanders backed this for the last 2 years and grew a good idea into something that is inviting the nation to get involved. Like Susie, you have to make this personal. When she took her son from Brisbane, from a fine private school here in Brisbane, to look at how Aboriginal children are schooled in those places, that young fellow Harry was also confronted, as my children were. The same experience Ian Thorpe. Once you've seen it, you cannot turn away. It's your responsibility to contribute. These are our children. So at very least tonight, I would urge you to think about the Reader's Challenge. You can register your office. You can do it yourself. If you are a school principal, get the kids in the school involved, and then they will flood you in the classroom with questions. Why is it that Aboriginal children are going to live 20 years less than me, sir? Why is it that we still have towns that don't have public libraries and where people can't find a book? Can you explain that, ma'am? And so we at least get the story into a discussion, a reading circle. And the profits from this Reader's Challenge, there are no gimmicks, no giveaway prizes. The $5 registration fee goes into a kitty. And I don't keep it. The Fred Hollows Foundation will take that money, buy the books at cost through the Australian Booksellers Association, convert a modest amount of money into a very useful resource. But beyond sending the right books, we're sending a message to the children themselves. And when I was last in the Jawan communities, a boy named Leroy Hood walked up to me one night and I had the most wonderful conversation. 5 years ago, that child was so shut down for all of the reasons that go with the trauma of life in his community that he would not have been able to express himself as he did. I can read, he said, and I want you to take this. And he handed me a painting of a little barra. another way of telling a story. And he said, I want you to sell this and put more of that good stuff into the literacy backpacks. And he thanked me. He said, I want to thank your children because they did something. I don't want to oversimplify it, but it is about making it personal. When we do, I think you will see that closing the gap in learning is perhaps the way, as a nation and as individuals, that we can close this space between us. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Okay, there's a challenge. Microphone's coming.
Thank you very much for that comprehensible and credible outline of events. I wonder if you'd like to say something more about really practical ways in which the situation can be redressed. In our society, we look to government to, of course, be very much involved in achieving the kinds of solutions that you allude to. So policies and programs that will help achieve these ends, how we're doing at the moment in terms of what governments are already doing, how it can perhaps be improved. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on whether, as features of European culture impinge on that very ancient culture that you referred to, whether that ultimately will lead to the disappearance of that ancient culture, or whether the two will be able to intermingle, and also whether solutions needed in remote communities need to be different from those affecting Indigenous people in urban settings.
Let me start by saying that Aboriginal people say to me, it has to be two ways learning. We don't want you to walk out in front, we want you to walk with us, is the common explanation for what they would also like to see in education. And Ernie Grant, who shaped the Indigenous Studies framework for this state, says that it is just as important for Claire and Will, my children, to understand the real timelines of history as it is for Leroy Hood, the boy up there in the Jawin communities. So the answer is, there really are not two timelines in history. There is truth, there is an authentic story from Gondwana, there is earth science before humans ever arrived here. If we were to look thoughtfully at this, it gives you a more respectful way of seeing what the animist belief system is all about, that the Indigenous view of human, the dawn, the children of the first sunrise, in fact is, not only has a beauty about it, but in fact it's an important timeline to teach all of our children. So it not only doesn't threaten the Indigenous child, it gives all of our children a clear orientation. I don't want to get into the history wars, and I don't want to get into the literacy wars about teaching methods. I don't think either of those are relevant, because Ernie Grant has said all of our children need to understand this. So once you do that, you in fact respect. People call it prehistory. I think that's a dangerous notion when it comes to, quite possibly, Mike Archer down at the Australian Museum says we may be talking about 10 millennia of human occupation. He doesn't buy the 60,000 years story. He thinks it's longer. If we're talking about 100,000 years of existence of people here, you can't call that. You can't get back to those notions of merely pre-European. You have to see there is a big story here. As people living on this land, we have to enrich it for all of our children. In that way, we will avoid the danger. But I don't want to dodge the political part of your question. It is true. In the schools at the moment, the Eurocentric obsession with beginning the story with Captain Cook is insulting to the Aboriginal student. My daughter one night came out with Anita Heiss's book, Mary Talents, The Diary of Mary Talents, which is a stolen generation story. And the little girl Mary says to a teacher, how can Captain Cook have discovered Australia when my people were already here? And Claire said, that's what it's all about, Dad. That's what's happening for the Aboriginal child. My child can understand that, and therefore she is in a position to respect the longer timelines of history. To the other parts of your question, as to what we can actually do when clearly government controls the purse strings of education, we can prepare government to believe that this is doable. At the moment, government shares the same doubts as many educators and most people out on the street, that this malaise, the culture of failure, is all the fault of the victims. We blame the victim for this situation instead of saying, let us start with the strong belief that these children can learn and can be strong. As we did after the tsunami, John Howard didn't make that intervention and send $1 billion in relief out of nowhere. It was because the nation clearly sent signals to Canberra that these, our neighbours, were in trouble. We haven't sent those signals to Canberra that we want all of our children to learn and to be strong. In fact, we've sent the opposite signal, that this is not important to me personally. It's not about parties and ideology, it's about making it personal. And then to the third part of your question, how do we connect? The reader's challenge may sound simple. It may be the only thing many people can do in the beginning, because in the process you are educating yourself to the complex issues about improving health and education. The next step, if you have an area of expertise, you don't have to go to a remote community. When 70% of Indigenous people live in our urban areas, on the outskirts of Brisbane, we have schools where children need help after school with reading. And often the teachers would love to have adults come and contribute their time. So right on our doorstep, I remind myself often, because I'm working mainly in remote communities, but the great bulk of those 460,000 Indigenous Australians are living on the outskirts of Sydney and Brisbane. I mean, they're not only 30% are in these terrible zones of distress, and yet the struggle to learn and the struggle to be strong and healthy, the struggle for equality is going on right here in the suburbs of Brisbane. So there is a way on your doorstep to go to an Aboriginal organisation or to a public school where Aboriginal children are attending and listen first of all, and then they will ask you to contribute in a way, given your skills, that you can.
Jeff, how important is it for Aboriginal youth to have an appreciation and understanding of their culture as a context for ongoing learning?
I don't think any child can really have that lifelong interest in learning unless you know who you are. And that is the first step of education. And there are wonderful examples at Yarrabah, just outside of Cairns, at Kuranda, up in the hill above Cairns, when Aboriginal parents got to work with the school and you had perhaps a courageous principal in the Chris Sara mould, they transformed that culture of failure into a belief. But it was built around recognising that each of those students had to be introduced, perhaps, to the novel idea that education was not a white thing. It's discovery. It's also interesting. It's putting that kid in the book or in the story. And they did it by a clever blend of earth science, storytelling, history, but locating the way most children are with good primary school teachers, lead them around the neighbourhood or your landscape or your own personal history. Tell me a poem about your great-grandfather in the Anzacs. That has to happen, and it's a richer process, I think, if white kids sitting alongside the Aboriginal kids can see that's an incredible story. How interesting to share in that. And then, instead of there being that space between, there is respect. But it's essential. It's a good question. Any other questions?
Microphone's coming.
Of the Royal Brisbane Hospital for 6 years, 1997 to 2003. And we had the problem out in the central Queensland with the health of the Aboriginals. And we were asked to come up with a problem. We put the x-rays on the trucks, we put the operating things on the trucks, and we drove them out, and we sent out staff to organise it, and then we got all our health professionals, and we flew them out. And we put them into the community, and we stuck them there for 14 days, and they worked solid, 12, 14 hours a day, driving straight through. The worst ones, we flew them back with us from that side. Now, it cost quite a bit of money, and it was a great success. What happened when Queensland Health turned around and looked at it and saw the costs? They cut its throat just like that. Your answer's there, and it can be done if we can eat.
Well, the ANU had a close look at the Northern Territory community that the Prime Minister visited about a year ago, but in the broader assessment, controversially, they estimated that roughly 40 cents was being spent on those children.